Plants capture CO2. What if we could help industrial plants capture it too? Think how we could help lower emissions. More and more scientists think carbon capture is key to reducing CO2 emissions globally. It's one way ExxonMobil is helping industrial plants be more like plants. That's the unexpected energy of ExxonMobil. On this week's Adam Schefter podcast, we are joined by two guests in the news. ESPN recently announced the hiring of Pat McAfee, who will be working Thursday night college football games and be appearing as an analyst on Get Up during the weekdays. And we'll also be joined by Brian Banks with a story that you will not believe and you will not want to miss. His life will come out on the movie screen Friday, August 9th, a movie that would have to be seen to be believed. Basically, Banks was wrongfully accused of rape by a high school classmate and went to prison for over 5 years before the LA District Attorney's Office and the judge there basically overturned that conviction and freed Banks at the age of 22 with basically 10 years of his life marred by something that he never did. We'll get to that story. But first, my newest teammate, Pat McAfee. Pat, thank you for joining the podcast.
Mr. Schefter, thank you so much for having me. You breaking news about my life was a monumental moment in my life. I'm so thankful for you tweeting about the college football Thursday night package I'm going to be a part of, and I'm excited to be back here on the Schefter podcast. I'm very pumped up about this.
You know, there was a listener, viewer, whatever you want to call it, follower, who, when you tweeted out last week, there's some big news that I have coming up here, and there was somebody that, like, challenged me and Woj to find out what it was. And Pat, when I saw that tweet, I took it personally. I said, I got to go get to the bottom of this and figure out what's up with Pat McAfee here. And so it was my honor to figure out that you're going to be coming to work for our company and you're going to be a part of the team. And I think it's a huge addition. It's going to be great. And I want to know how that marriage came together. How did that happen? How does Pat McAfee come to work for ESPN?
Well, it came very quickly, to be honest. When I say that, I mean it. It all came to be in the last, like, 5 days before your tweet. It was one of those things where I have a great relationship with Greeny in the Get Up cast, and there was always interest in me potentially making an appearance in a studio show there for ESPN, because I've been learning a lot about the way ESPN operates. There's, like, 45 different businesses within the grander business. So there was some interest from the studio department, and then Lee Fitting there kind of heard about it, and he said, you know what, if nobody else is going to let him call some games, I'll let him do it. And it all kind of came to be very fast. Matt Hasselbeck was helping me out a lot and behind the scenes, saying he wanted me to join his team on Thursday nights, and it all kind of came to be pretty quickly. And I love the fact that you're an internet watchdog. Like, if something's out there, there's a 100% chance old Shefty's going to get to the bottom of it.
That's very kind of you to say. I appreciate that. So on Thursday nights, you're doing college football for ESPN. You're working with Adam Amin, Molly McGrath, and the aforementioned Matthew Hasselbeck, your former teammate in Indianapolis. What is the relationship between the two of you like?
So Matt and I have a very hilarious relationship. I mean, he's a man who comes from football prestige, right? The Hasselbeck family has been deep in the NFL world and in the football world since the beginning of time. You know, Matt tells a story about being a ball boy for the Patriots way back in the day. Then he was a quarterback for 18 years, and when he got to the Colts, he was tasked with basically, like, hey, help Andrew Luck become this superstar elite NFL quarterback, kind of show him the ropes. And then Andrew got hurt, so Hasselbeck became our starting quarterback in a time where I don't think he was expecting it. And what he did was lead our team in an incredible fashion, started knocking down wins, 4, 5, 6 in a row. And I was a pretty, you know, boisterous personality in the locker room. I liked having good relationships with everybody, and I got along with him very well from, like, the moment we met. And it's just a great relationship. And I think it's going to be one that's going to come through very well on the screen. I think his X's and O's brain with his personality that I don't think he's fully showcased yet.
Yeah.
And me knowing a good bit about football, I couldn't tell you what the job of an outside linebacker is in cover two or whatever, but I have a pretty good football IQ. I got a chance to be around the greats. I think with my personality mixed with our friendship, I think we're going to be special in there. And I've heard Adam Amin is an incredible character, and everybody knows Molly's awesome sideline reporter. So I got very lucky to be put with this team, and I'm excited to be partnered back up with Hasselbeck.
Not to repulse any of the listeners, but do you have any naked pictures of Matthew?
Thank God that did not happen with me and Hasselbeck. I mean, you know, me and Andrew Luck have a very interesting relationship due to a photo that I posted of Vinatieri where Andrew Luck was a lot of thigh in the background. So that might have affected our friendship a little bit. But no Hasselbeck naked, which is I'm very thankful of.
And what will viewers get on Thursday Night Football from you?
Well, I think, honestly, I think you know this from watching football, and I noticed it when I was playing, and then when I retired with my internet videos, there's an entire down that happens that not a lot of TV people have covered for the last, I don't know, 150 years of college football, 100 years of the NFL. Mm-hmm. I think I can really add some interesting tidbits about the special teams field that might make it more interesting for a lot more people, which is good for the game of football. But I've also got a chance to be front row. We're talking in-team meetings, inside post-game locker rooms for a team that was undefeated until we chose to lose, and then for a team that was almost completely defeated. And if you have any observational genes in your body, you can kind of pick things up on what's good and what isn't good. And I've been very fortunate to be around a lot of great players. I've been very fortunate to be on teams that haven't come together well. So I think I can add some quips about what it's like in experiencing the highs and lows of both college football and the NFL. And I think I'll be able to add a little bit of an enjoyable experience, I hope. And if not, I get fired week three, and that's okay. I mean, we gave it a good go.
Well, let me say this. Last year you did the Baylor-Texas Tech game in November, and then you did the Lions-Packers game in December. And in that Lions-Packers game, and I wish we had the rights to broadcast the call here, we're not allowed to do it, you had the incredible call where Matt Prater, the Lions kicker, had a fake field goal and wound up throwing a touchdown pass, and you, in the booth, lost your mind. And it was awesome television. How much do you think that call put you on the broadcasting map, got people's attention, and made what is happening with ESPN possible?
You know, I would assume, thank you for referencing that. I mean, that's a highlight of my life. And a lot of people talk about Tony Romo predicting plays. If you listen to that play, before the ball is even snapped, I say touchdown, basically. And it was just, it was such a cool moment. And I do believe that the Lions did that because they knew I was going to be in the booth. I do believe that they chose not to tell me because they wanted my natural reaction. This was told to me by the punter on the team and a guy who was their special teams assistant at the time. And it was just a raw, enjoyable moment. I love seeing people succeed, and I think that's a really different perspective that I'm bringing into the booth. I think anytime you see one thing bad happen on a football field, there's probably 10 good things happening as well. That just so happened to be the most awesome thing to ever happen on a football field. So I lost my mind. I had a good time with it. The internet seemed to love it. And anytime you do damage like that in a Week 17 game with no playoffs on the line and a 31-0 blowout where Aaron Rodgers gets hurt literally on the second play, I would assume that some people with brains go, you know what, let's see what this is like on a weekly basis. But I wasn't offered a job immediately after that. I mean, it took some time, and I'm very thankful for my representation getting the job done and Lee Fitting taking a shot on me. And hopefully there will be plenty more of those moments as we venture through this college football season.
How much are you reminded of that call on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis?
It'll show up in my Twitter timeline like every other day or so. You know, like Field Yates put it out whenever we did the announcement, so I'm very thankful for him bringing it back up. you know, it's better than the lowlights getting brought back up all the time. There are a couple of me and playing foosball where there's some lowlights that get mentioned. So anytime that shows up in my life, I'm excited about it because it was just a magical moment in there. And I'm very lucky that Prater has the arm of one of the football gods.
It was a great play. It was a better call. I'm not surprised to hear that they may have been catering to you in the press box for all that attention. Look, if their season's lost, you might as well have some fun with it and make sure that Pat McAfee gets the call of his life there, right? I mean, that makes sense.
I would like to think that they did it 100% for me, but, you know, Matty Patricia, their coach, is a big-brained individual. He probably knew he could get a little advantage on the field as well, but I like to think that they 100% in the team meeting. You heard McAfee's allowed in the booth. We got to do something awesome in the special teams. Anybody who has any good ideas, I want to hear them. Bang, we'll do the sleeper play, hideout play, touchdown. He'll lose his mind. Good mojo going into the Lions offseason.
You've had this decorated career. You're a two-time Pro Bowl punter, first-team All-Pro. You went, of course, as people know, to West Virginia, became a seventh-round draft pick. How did the announcement that you were joining ESPN compare to some of these other football milestones that you've achieved in your life, including walking away from the game in February of 2017 to go join Barstool and do stand-up comedy and do all the great things that you've done?
Well, I retired from the NFL on Comedy Central with my friends at Barstool. So that was a hilarious move. A lot of people thought it was fake. That obviously got a bit of a reaction because it came out of nowhere. My mom and dad weren't excited about it either, but they've come around. It's just like everything for me just is an experience. It's a story. I'm very lucky. I'm very, very lucky. I get to have a lot of fun. I think when I retired, a lot of people might have called me dumb, but I thought that there was a chance some good stuff might happen if I'm given a good opportunity. And I got a chance to learn a lot while I was with Barstool. And then whenever I started doing my own thing, I kind of just woke up every day with my boys and made good stuff on the internet. And we kept building a fan base and building a following. And they're my team, you know, like not only my boys in the office, but my followers, they're my team. So anytime anything happens, everybody gets excited. And whenever you get a chance to work with an incredible, ESPN is it, you know? So anytime you get a chance to and get a shot with ESPN, especially on a primetime game, I mean, my team was excited, and it's been a very, very cool experience.
Your team is unbelievable because every time there was an announcement of some sort about Monday Night Football, Jason Witten leaving, Booger McFarland in the booth, the reaction on the Twitter timeline was Pat McAfee. That's what your team made known to the masses, that they wanted you to be a part of that. And I wonder how much their help influenced the public opinion, the public perception of you joining ESPN.
Well, I am nothing without my team, which is obviously everybody I mentioned in the last answer. And it's a real thing. The Monday Night Football thing was such a hilarious momentum that started just gaining and going. What a campaign that really started going. And now that I went to the college football seminar and got a chance to meet all the great directors and producers in the college football world and all the incredible analysts and play-by-play people, I think it was a little bit of an aggressive movement, an aggressive campaign by us for us to never have a job and kind of pitch for that. But I'm a very fortunate dude with the people I got in my back. And I started tweeting, you know, 140 characters at a time back in the day, when you had to quote tweet instead of you had to actually copy and paste people's tweets whenever you could respond to everybody. And when I first got on Twitter, I literally answered every human that tweeted me. So I got a chance to build up this family type camaraderie with my first like 50,000 to 100,000 followers. And since then, I try to treat it the exact same way. And no offense to ESPN, I'm very lucky to have a job with them now, but they were not promoting my Twitter much. There wasn't a lot of mainstream networks promoting my Twitter. It was actually much more the opposite. So I have this grassroots group of humans behind me that I think they view me as like their friend who just so happens to get opportunities. And if I blow it, they'll look at me exactly how they would look at their friend who messed up an opportunity. And I enjoy it, to be honest. I very much enjoy it. But the Monday Night Football campaign, I've learned, was a bit aggressive.
Can you say or project where this is all going, where you would like it to go? What is this leading to, if you had to guess, right now, today?
I would, I would like to become a weapon as the third guy in the booth. I would really enjoy that. And by guy, I don't mean all men booths. I'm just saying me being the third person in a booth, I would like to become a weapon where they feel confident they can drop me in any booth and I can add something. If it's Wimbledon, they can drop me in Wimbledon as the third person and I'll be able to add something. I mean, it's going to take some learning. I'm going to have to figure out the rules of being in the booth. The seminar obviously helped out a lot, but I think I'm the only player in history that's been rejected from the broadcast boot camp three times. They didn't let me in. So I don't have a lot of TV or broadcast knowledge. I'm just kind of just from what I've watched on TV. But I would like to become a weapon as somebody that they can just put in any booth. Like, here we go. Let's put this guy in here. Let's see how it goes. And if it ends up being, you know, some primetime stuff, I think that's awesome. But that's where I would like it to go. And I would like to become a weapon for ESPN.
Well, if I could do NBA, then you could do Wimbledon. So should that be the headline for this, that Pat McAfee is now going to be launching a campaign to take over in the booth for Wimbledon, like with Chris Evert and Chris Fowler and all the McEnroe brothers?
Listen, I am a massive tennis guy, okay? I hate that Djokovic beat Federer just because I'm a Federer guy through and through, but I respect it. You only said Wimbledon just to state my case that I would like ESPN to get so comfortable with me being able to be dropped in any booth that they feel like they could put me anywhere. The Home Run Derby, and if it's in the football world, I love it. Just, that's what I want to become. I want to become a weapon third person in there. I'm never going to be an expert on the analysis of things. I don't think you're ever going to get that out of me, but I also don't think anybody would want to hear that out of me. But I would just like to make the viewing experience better for everybody, and hopefully I can do that.
You talk about having fun. Where do you get that attitude that everything to you is as fun as it is? Where does that come from?
So for me, once I started realizing that terrible situations are just really good stories, yeah. I think that's when everything kind of flipped for me. You know, I hit rock bottom there after I got arrested for the public intoxication on October 20th, 2010. I was made fun of by everybody. And it got to the point where people who had never met me before were saying things about me as if it was a matter of fact. And it was a learning lesson where I was like, listen, people are going to hate you regardless. So you got to stop caring about whether or not people like you. I'm going to just continue to be me. And one day this will be a good story. And it was kind of just a life altering moment for me. When you hit rock bottom, it's a tough one. Whenever you were drinking and partying way too much, you're taking advantage of situations, and then it all comes crashing down very publicly. I mean, that's a moment that you remember. And I had a great support team with my mom and dad, and it was just kind of one of those situations where everything changed for me. And I was like, I'm going to enjoy the hell out of this life. Some people are going to like me. Some people are going to hate me. And if something sucks, it's just going to be a great story. So I try to enjoy everything. I really do. Every single moment I try to enjoy. And the McAfee family tree is not a tall one, so I'm probably going to die young if I had to guess, and I'm going to make sure every day is a good one.
Well, and you have done that, and that's interesting because I think when we all look back in our life and some of those disappointments and some of those awkward moments, they do make for the best stories always, right? So if you could laugh at your own arrest and your own public intoxication, then that certainly changes your perspective on things, I would think.
Well, it wasn't just my arrest or in public intoxication. I mean, it was a national embarrassment to the McAfee family name. I mean, it was just a lot of people didn't even know I existed in Indianapolis. They thought Hunter Smith was still the punter. And the first thing they hear of me is that I got arrested. And now, granted, the fact that I was partying in a very large party area here in Indianapolis, I think I gained some respect amongst the college and co-eds around here. For me, it was one of those moments where I didn't laugh at it at the time, but as I kind of pushed through the sorrow that I was feeling for myself for being an idiot, and I kind of came out the other side of it, it just made me a much better human. And it sounds crazy, but I'm very lucky for that moment because I have no idea where I'd be right now.
Let me give you some advice from ESPN employee to ESPN employee. Don't let that happen again.
Yeah, that I've heard that that's not a great thing, but
no.
Also as an NFL employee after that, by the way, that was very much understood as well, you know. And I also do work with the WWE now too, so it's like I'm very lucky that a lot of people have put faith in me, and it's my job to make those people look like geniuses for giving me jobs.
I mean, if you're going to be arrested and charged with public intoxication, which is a Class B misdemeanor, I'm going to guess that you're not going to hold the title as the third man in that booth or that Matt Hasselbeck partner having the fun that you get to have very much longer.
Yeah, and I want to buy an island, Shefty, so I think that is anything that gets in the way of that is not the right thing for me. And I got 12 employees I got to take care of as well, one of them being my dad and one of them being my brother. So
they work for you? They're part of the McAfee team?
Yeah, my dad runs the foundation full-time out of the office, and my brother is a graphic designer / beat maker. And I'm very, very lucky and happy that my family works with me on a day-to-day basis, and I got my dad out of his blue-collar, just callous hands job there for a bit. And, I got a lot of people dependent upon me, and I got a lot of incredible opportunity, and there's zero chance that I do some dumb stuff again. I think I'm so focused on everything, and it's just it's a really cool time for me to be alive.
What does your dad think of what has happened to your career?
Well, I think me included, like, everything's stupid. You know, like, everything is just dumb. Like, when Michael Cole called me and asked me if I wanted to work for the WWE, like, that's dumb. Like, that's not supposed to actually happen. Whenever my podcast does what it does and an advertiser or sponsor says they want to pay me something to do something, like, that's just dumb. Like, I think my dad learning about the business more and more, and especially now that I get a chance to team up with ESPN, he just, I think he questions all the days he woke up at like 4 a.m. to go drive a truck thousands of miles and come back home at 6 p.m. and just do anything he could to put food on the table for us. I think that's his overall thought, but he's an incredibly proud man of me, which makes me feel very good and keeps me going, to be honest.
And how much prouder would he be if you could go ahead and make your dream come true of buying your own island?
Well, I don't know how much my mom would love it, because I'd probably just disappear there down there. But my dad is just everything I'm about. My dad just tries to be as supportive as possible. And I think he'd want a little hut down there on the island if he could. But my dad loves doing what he's doing with the foundation. And every day, like, it's something new in there. And he feels young again, I think.
And where would this island be in a perfect world, Pat?
It would be warm. I mean, the Caribbean's a little bit too hot. I sweat a lot, so it would be a little bit too humid there. We'd have to go a little bit north. But I would like it to be a warm island. And the island doesn't have to technically be like a Caribbean island. Like, right now, my house is kind of an island because I got like 15 acres, so I'm just kind of out here all by myself. That's kind of my mindset. But I would like to have a beach to look at every day.
That would be pretty awesome. And 15 acres is pretty awesome in and of itself right there. I mean, that shows how much success you've had kicking, broadcasting, podcasting, humoring, all kinds of things.
Well, stand-up comedy, whenever I was in the NFL, I wasn't enjoying going to work anymore my last couple of years. And I was just going to try stand-up comedy. And I've become great friends with a man named Bob Kavoyan, who was on the Bob and Tom show, which was his morning show for 35 years. It's still on. He's retired, but syndicated on like 170 stations. A lot of stand-up comedians have come through there. It's just, they're based out of Indianapolis. It's just an elder statesman in the comedy world. So I got a chance to work with them a little bit, and comedians would come in and I chat with the comedians, and some of these comedians were making a lot of money, and whenever we were off air, they weren't really that funny, and they're writing down punchlines and all this stuff, and I was like, hey, these guys aren't even that funny. So Bob Kavoyan was like, well, why don't you do stand-up then? So I rented out a theater while I was still in the NFL. It was like an 1,800-seater or a 2,000-seater, and I put up the tickets for sale on Twitter, and it sold out in like 8 minutes, right?
Wow.
Or something like that, like 7 minutes. So then we had to put another show on. It sold out. These are all my Twitter followers, my team. And I think they were coming to watch me either crash or do well, right? They were coming for the show regardless. If it was terrible, it's going to be a great story. If it's good, we loved it. We're a part of it. And I realized the amount of money that I made from running out the theater, selling the ticket myself, running all the advertising. So I realized that there was money off the field. And as I continued to not really get excited to go to work anymore, it just kind of became one of those things where I was like, okay, I'm going to keep this work off the field. And then if I retire, I retire. And the stand-up comedy world was honestly the whole thing that made me realize that, hey, if you can do things good, there's a happy life to be had for you, your family, and your friends.
You know, it's interesting because I remember when you walked away from the Colts in February 2017, I thought to myself, that's crazy. Like, wow, walking away from that job and that money to go into this business, why would somebody do it? And now, more than 2 years later, I understand why.
Well, I think, by the way, I think your mindset was one that was very natural for everybody. And Mike Wilbon, I remember the day I retired. It was on, pardon the interruption. Mike Wilbon, he alluded to the fact that I didn't have any good friends because my friends should have held the jersey on me as long as I possibly could, right? And that became like motivation. And then Jimmy Fallon did a joke in his opening monologue that was like, the Colts punter retired and turned down the rest of his $6 million salary, blah, 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 to do whatever. And then he made a joke about the other players saying, wait, we're paying our punter $6 million, something like that. Like I was literally, it got back to the point where there was a lot of people doubting me, right? So yep. It got to the point where I'm a chip on the shoulder guy, always have been. I had to succeed, not only for me and for my friends that quit their jobs the same night I did to come work for me, but for anybody in the future who's like, you know what, I'm going to try to go after it and chase it. I had to be successful, and I'm not there yet, but I think I'm on the road to justifying all the thoughts that I had the last couple months before retirement.
Well, I think you've justified it. Are you doing better financially now than you were as a punter?
Yeah.
Am I allowed to ask that question?
You are allowed to ask that question.
And
a lot of people wonder that. But, yeah, and I have a full company. So, I mean, it's, yeah, things have been good here. I've been very lucky, and hopefully they'll continue that way. And I'll be able to take care of everybody that's been a part of my team for a long time.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining the podcast today, Pat. And I also want to tell you, after you get done listening to yourself, if you wind up listening to this podcast, I cannot recommend the next guest to you enough. Do you know anything about the Brian Banks story?
Oh, so Brian Banks and I spoke on a panel at the Rookie Symposium.
Together?
Together. Yeah, I love that man. What a perseverance tale. There's some justification and vindication, but also a man that has stayed so positive. I don't think I would have been able to do it.
You hit the nail on the head. He is the next guest coming up, and we spoke before, and I was blown away by that guy's message. So in my mind, I have one of the most entertaining people in the broadcast, podcast, football, whatever you want to call it, industry, WWE, and I've got a guy that has a message that, honestly, I don't know that I've ever heard before from anybody. So this, to me, is one of the podcasts that I'm very proud of putting together. I thank you for being half of it and part of it. And Brian Banks will be coming up right after you, Pat.
Well, I'm honored to share a podcast here, not only with you, an absolute legend in the media world, Adam Bomb after Adam Bomb until the top of the world. But the fact that I get a chance to have my name next to Brian Banks again is one that I'm very proud of. He's an inspirational dude. I think people are going to enjoy your conversation with him, and I enjoyed this conversation with you greatly. I hope people didn't hate it too much.
Pat, you're the man. Welcome to the team. Honored to be a teammate of yours. Very excited about it. Going to be a great hire for our company, and I'm really happy you're part of it. And there is the great Pat McAfee. We'll have Brian Banks in that aforementioned interview on deck. But first, a message from Lightstream. Credit card bills, every month you get them with multiple payments and multiple due dates. Wouldn't it be easier to have just one payment at a lower rate? You can with a credit card consolidation loan from my friends at Lightstream. Get a rate as low as 5.95 APR with AutoPay, lower than the average credit card interest rate of over 19% APR. Plus, the rate is fixed, so it will never go up over the life of the loan. You can get a loan from $5,000 to $100,000 with no fees. And you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. The online application is so easy, you can apply right now from your phone. Lightstream believes that people with good credit deserve a better loan experience, and that's exactly what they deliver. Just for my listeners, apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/Adam. LIGHTSTREAM.com/ADAM. Subject to credit approval, rate includes 0.50% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/Adam for more information.
HBO Sports, NFL Films, and the Oakland Raiders team up for an unfiltered, all-access look at what it takes to make it in the National Football League. When Hard Knocks, training camp with the Oakland Raiders kicks off its 5-episode season Tuesday, August 6th. The new season of the groundbreaking sports reality series spotlights the historic AFC West franchise that has an intriguing mix of established veterans, highly regarded rookie hopefuls, and free agent acquisitions under head coach John Gruden. Each week, viewers will get an inside look as players experience the daily rigors of an NFL training camp as they compete for a roster spot. Don't miss Hard Knocks, training camp with the Oakland Raiders, Tuesdays at 10 p.m., kicking off August 6th, only on HBO.
And next up is a man who is an inspirational figure, somebody whose life will be made into a movie and released on Friday, August 9th. Back in 2002, he gave a verbal commitment to USC head coach Pete Carroll to attend USC. He was a four-star recruit middle linebacker out of Long Beach Poly in California. But then, before he could go to USC, he was wrongfully accused and later convicted of rape by a high school classmate. Rather than facing 41 years to life in prison if he fought the charges and lost, Banks took a plea deal and was sentenced to 5 years in prison. He wound up serving 5 years and 2 months in prison from the age of 16 till the age of 22. The California Innocence Project, which is a nonprofit organization that investigates and litigates cases of factual innocence, presented the evidence of Banks' innocence to the LA District Attorney's Office, and on May 24, 2012, Banks' conviction was reversed in LA Superior Court. He was locked up for nothing. His football career was foiled, his life was derailed, but he has gotten everything back on track, and he's here to join us today with his new movie coming out on Friday, August 9th, Brian Banks. What do we say about this journey? How do we put this journey into words, Brian?
Oh, man. You know what? That's a good question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. I would say how we would categorize this journey is a unique experience, but not a unique a situation. How I went through what I went through and what actually happened to me and what I experienced, when you put it all together, it is a very, very unique situation. But the concept of wrongful convictions, of being accused of something that you didn't do, of being convicted of something that you didn't do, that is all too familiar and all too common in our society. So I would say this is just a very nightmarish, traumatic experience that has a triumphant and resilient component at the ending of it, of the unbroken spirit and the never ending the will to never give up and to never give in to adversary, man.
And we're going to get into your prison stay and never giving up and never giving in and wrongful convictions and all those things. But I want to know what it's like for you now to have your story being told in a movie that's being released across the country on August 9th, where everybody is going to see the Brian Banks movie, the Brian Banks story. And see your story come to the big screen. What has that been like for you?
You know what? I'll say this. It has been a long time coming. You know, regardless of the amazing experiences that come within the next few days, regardless of the tangible things that I've received since my release, regardless of any of the accomplishments, it does not take away. Or it does not make light of the 10 years that I lost. It wasn't just 10 years lost, but it was 10 years in captivity. You know, I was kidnapped from my home. I was kidnapped from my mother and her care. I was taken into custody and put into a cage like an animal. And I was made to sit there in that cage for 5 years and 2 months from the age of 16 to 22. So you know, yes, today I'm in a moment. I'm in a space where there's a film that's being made about my life and my journey, the story of mine and my story of my family's. But it doesn't eliminate the experience and what we went through and what we had to deal with. And I think that is one of the reasons why this film is so important, is that it's not just a story of Brian Banks, man, but it's a story of so many people, and it's a story that needs to be heard. And I'm glad that I'm in a space where I'm able to not only been vindicated and cleared of the charges, which is a very rare thing for people that have been wrongfully convicted, but to also be in a space now to be a voice and a representation of the many flaws within our judicial system. You know?
But when you get sentenced to prison and you serve 5 years and 2 months from the ages of 16 to 22, when you have basically a verbal commitment to then USC head coach Pete Carroll in 2002 to go play football for him because you're a four-star recruit at middle linebacker who played high school football at Long Beach Poly in California. When you have all that going for you and your life is derailed, how do you keep the faith and how do you bounce back from something like that to get your life on track or to try to get your life on track, Brian?
Yeah, man. I always tell people, like anything mastered, it takes time and practice. You know, when you initially came up with the idea that you wanted to be the best football player, you know, in the country or the best basketball player in the country, you didn't make that idea go to sleep and woke up the next day and you were there. You had to sacrifice and wake up early and go to bed late, and you had to, you know, stop hanging around certain people and bring in new friends that were into the same things that you were in. You know, your whole priorities had to change in order to get to where you wanted to be in your accomplishments. That was exactly what I had to do in this situation. To see myself, you know, be in a position where, you know, I could have went to college on a full scholarship to play football, and to lose that and to lose a potential NFL career, it was hard initially. You know, it was something that I didn't know how to process. I didn't know how I was going to be able to deal with it. For a long period of time, I had to let sports go completely. I had to let go of football when I was in prison, knowing that I had years to serve and knowing that football may be something of the past for me. I had to refocus my whole mind and my perception in order to get out of prison sanely. But what really got me through it, dealing with it all and that whole traumatic experience, was just knowing how much I wanted for me, and knowing that no one would work harder for me than me and the things that I wanted in life, and knowing that I couldn't allow this one moment in time to dictate the duration of my life, that I wanted more for me, and I wanted to distance myself and be better than the labels and accusations that were made against me. So I had to learn how to be in control of my emotions and not allow my emotions to control me. I had to find some way to be in control of myself while in an uncontrolled experience, an unwanted experience. And it really just became, it went from working hard to be the best football player I can be to literally working as hard as I can to be the best Brian Banks that I could be, the best human being that I could be. And that is what truly got me through the hardest moments of my life, was self-empowering me and wanting more for myself than where I was in that moment.
But that has got to be so hard to maintain hope when you're that age and so much is taken from you, and unfairly and unjustly, not to mention. Yep. I mean, that it's hard to even imagine all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's still hard for me to imagine it. I sat there last night at the premiere of our film in Long Beach, California, and I've watched the movie a number of times now, and still, you know, even though I was the one who lived it, I watched the movie, and I'm often shocked at just how much I went through and how much I had to deal with. And it took some time to, you know, get to a point to where I started working on emotions and working on myself and trying to be better than the action, the accusations and labels against me. Before that, I was angry. I was furious. I wanted revenge. I wanted people to be held accountable for what had happened to me. I wanted people to know that, you know, what the results and the effects of lies could do to a person's life. And that's still part of my journey now, you know, advocating for other wrongfully convicted people just informing people about, you know, the choices and the things that you do in life, and it could affect someone else's life, you know, in a very, very traumatic way. You know, I just try and I try not to think too much about where I was then, and I focus now more on where I am today and being in this space where I could help other people in similar situations.
So you're at that movie premiere, and you're watching your life story unfold in front of your eyes. How accurate was the story compared to what you went through?
It's really accurate. You know, one thing that I respected and admired about Tom Shadyac, the director of the film, was that he wanted this to be as authentic as possible. You know, obviously this is still a movie, and people want to be entertained, so you got to put a couple splices of Hollywood into a film in order to carry it. But I would say if I was to put this on a percentage, you know, we're somewhere, I'm talking 90 to 95% accurate in how they depicted my journey and my story. And that was something I was really appreciative of, is that, you know, by the time the film ended, you know, as far as them creating the film, you know, I was still Brian Banks. I was still a football player. Like, the story didn't change in order to fit Hollywood's bill. You know, they understood me when I said, if you tell my story exactly the way it happened, people will still think that you made it up. That's how crazy it was.
When you watched the movie, Brian, what was the most emotional part for you? Was it as emotional as the part that you actually lived through while you were incarcerated?
Yeah. I think the most emotional part for me watching a film is just to watch, honestly, to just watch my mom and watch her struggle. You know, being a mother, I know, I always tell people, I know what it feels like to be wrongfully convicted, to be snatched up from your home and taken into custody. I know what it feels like to be wrongfully accused and ultimately convicted of something that you didn't do. I know what it feels to sit inside of a prison cell. I know what it feels like to be in the hole in solitary confinement. What I don't know what it feels like is to be a mother, and a mother who does every single thing that she can to protect her child, to save her child. And those efforts fall on deaf ears. To watch my mom walk away defeated, I don't know what that feels like, to sell your house, to sell your car, just so that you can pay for an attorney to save your child from an experience. Like, I don't know what that feels like, but she does. So I think, you know, just to watch her journey be shown in this movie, I would say, you know, it affected me the most just because I love mom so much. I'm such a mama's boy. And I hate that she had to go through what she went through. And, you know, I hate that we had to go through what we went through. And, you know, my heart is always with her. She has always had my back from day one. So,
well, you know what they say about parents, right? You're only as happy as your least happy child. So if her baby is in prison, incarcerated, fighting something that he didn't do, accused of something that he never took part in, and she knows it and you know it, you both have to be completely miserable and suffering beyond words.
You know, we were brand new to the judicial system. We had never dealt with court before. We'd never dealt with a criminal case, attorneys and DAs and lawyers. You know, we were completely blindsided by all of this and really just kind of, you know, took the advice of people that we put trust into, and we had no idea that the people we were putting trust into were people that we shouldn't trust. You know, this the whole ordeal, the whole experience, man, it really left a footprint in our lives, and, you know, you can still see it today.
What did you learn about it?
What did I learn about this experience? Man, you know, I learned a few things. Number one, I learned that our system, our judicial system, is not perfect, that there are flaws within the system, and that these flaws can be fixed. But unfortunately, we have a system that is built on upholding a conviction rate, being tough on crime, versus what we said that our justice system should be about, which is Lady Liberty, holding a scale that should be balanced. In support of equal rights and justice and so forth. And that's not the case. You know, we're 95 to 97% of all criminal cases in the United States ends in some form of a plea bargain. and only 3 to 5% of those cases actually go on a trial. It doesn't mean that 95 to 97% of people are guilty. It means that they're also being forced into deals, feared into deals, exhausted into deals. We have a court system that's built on a plea bargaining system. You know, we have a system where one out of every three African-American males will experience some form of incarceration throughout their lifetime. You know, we live in a system where young children, kids under that are not in their adulthood, are being tried as adults and sent to adult court to face crimes where they could be sent to prison for 20, 30, 40 years at the age of 15 and 16 years old. You know, we have so many flaws within our system, and these things are happening because we have a book that says that it's allowed to happen. This is a man-made book ordained, you know, that's been created by man that says, hey, man, you can give somebody 1,000 years for this crime. If a book says you can do it, then that's what they're going to go for. And even if they know you didn't commit that crime, if I can still get you to take a plea bargain, if I can get you to take a deal, then I can uphold my conviction rate. Then I can still say that I'm tough on crime. And then being tough on crime, it benefits a district attorney. That's how they become appointed. That's how they move up in their career. So there's just so many different things that exposes the flaws within our system that people need to be aware of, that I think we as a country and as a society should want to come together and see that those things change for the better. And then I think that what I also learned is that you know, during the hardest moments of my life was when I discovered the most about who I am, what I'm capable of, how strong I actually am, what I can deal with and what I couldn't deal with. I learned so much about myself during the hardest moments in my life, and that would probably be one thing that I would not want to take away from this whole experience, was the life lessons that were given to me, and the fact that I didn't quit and that I didn't give up. You know, those are things that I will take with me forever. I'm still here.
And to those who don't know, you were basically facing 41 years to life in prison if you fought the charges and lost. You took the plea deal that was basically forced upon you and were sentenced to 5 years in prison. And then back in 2012, the California Innocence Project, a nonprofit organization that investigates and litigates cases of innocence, factual innocence, presented the evidence of your case to the district attorney out in L.A. And on May 24th, 2012, L.A. Superior Court reversed that conviction. You were released. When you are released and get that news, what is that like, and what is it like to walk out of prison, not just a free man, but knowing that you're a free man who spent 5 years and 2 months in prison when you never should have?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing about that, Adam, is that I paroled from prison at the age of 22 in 2007. I had spent 6 birthdays and holidays behind bars away from my family and my freedom. So from 16 to 22, I was in prison. When I paroled in 2007, I was naive into thinking that things would be better. And in fact, it was a lot worse. When I paroled home and came home, I was then placed on strict custody parole for an additional 5 years of my life.
Wow.
That required me to wear a GPS tracking device on my ankle. I had to register as a sex offender. I could live within 2,000 feet of any school or park. All of the restrictions that you would put on somebody who deserved it, I had to live those restrictions post-prison. So I was moved from one form of being institutionalized to another form of incarceration. So 5 years later, to making this a whole 10-year ordeal, I'm sitting inside of a courtroom on May 24th, 2012, and I finally hear the words from the district attorney saying that they concede to the matter and that they want this case to be overturned and I be exonerated. And then to finally hear the judge, the same judge who convicted me, who sent me to prison for 6 years, was the same judge that I stood in front of 10 years later. And hearing him say the words that he agreed with the DA and that they would overturn this conviction, I remember I was shaking. I was uncontrollably shaking. I remember dropping my head to the table and putting my arms around my head and And, you know, there's a video, if you go on, you know, YouTube, you see this video, and it looks like I'm just on the table crying, man, but really my eyes were as wide as they could be. And I was clenching my fists, and I just felt life being restored back into my body. I felt freedom being given back to my life. And in that moment, so much weight was lifted from my body, from my shoulders. But then there was also this bittersweet moment of why? Why did this even have to happen to me in the first place? Why did it take 10 years for people to finally figure out that this didn't happen? You know, so, you're happy, you're excited, you're overwhelmed that it's finally over, that you're finally able to tell people, I told you, I was innocent. But then there's also this whole thing about why? Why did this even have to happen to me? You know, it's a tough thing to really wrap your head around.
You talked about the fact that you know what it's like to be in a cell, what it's like to be in solitary confinement. During the 5 years and 2 months that you were incarcerated, what did you miss most? I know it's an obvious question, I guess. Maybe there's an obvious answer. But what did you most missed about being a regular
free
person?
Man, I think what I missed most was just freedom itself. I don't think that we realize what all we have until we're taken away from everything. And that's the situation that I was put in. You know, little things, you know. I I miss my mom, I miss my family, I miss football, I miss school. You know, those are the obvious things. But then it's like those little things. I miss being able to get up and open up my bedroom door when I wanted to. I miss being able to go into the kitchen and open the refrigerator just to see what's in there and close it back. I miss being able to go outside at nighttime and just sit on the steps and look into the sky and check out the stars and look at the moon. You know, I miss being able to walk on my 12th grade year and graduate with my senior class. You know, I never got a chance to go to college and fulfill that scholarship opportunity. Maybe join a fraternity. What kind of friends I would have made, or, you know, what kind of degree I could have gotten from school. There's so many things I could tell you about what I missed and what all passed me by as I sat there in one space. You know, it's crazy, man. You definitely miss a lot. You come home and, when I got home, I got home in 2007. Everybody was into social media. Everybody was on MySpace and Facebook and, phones were playing music. And, there was still Nokias and flip phones and stuff like that. I remember calling a buddy of mine while I was in prison. He gave me his number and I called him. And instead of a ringtone ringing and start playing music, and just seeing technology and things just advance in front of you, man, while you sit there in this little box and nothing changes. You know, you eat the same crappy food every day. You're dealing with the same angry inmates every day. You're dealing with the same, corrupted jail system. Man, it's just, you're kind of dealing with a lot. And then in the back of your head, you're always reminded, I'm not even supposed to be here. I shouldn't even be dealing with this.
So how do you get adjusted? How do you reacclimate to society when you've been locked in a cell, same thing over and over again every day?
Man, there really is no method to the madness. I think that you just have to, what you want in this world, you have to put into the world. You want love, you want respect, you want people to treat you kind. You have to put those things out there. You know, I couldn't come home bitter, angry, aggressive and upset and expect people to treat me with love and be gentle and be vulnerable with me. So I think it's important that what we want out of the world, we have to understand we have to put into the world. And just one day at a time, man, it was hard coming home. First few days I came home, I remember I went to the mall with a couple of friends, high school friends of mine, and I think I was probably 72 hours out of jail or out of prison, and I had a panic attack inside the mall. There's just so many people walking around and zigzagging through, in front of you and around you, bumping into you, and, all the stores were really tight in spaces. You're going through all of these clothes racks and stuff like that. I had a panic attack. It was just different. I had to familiarize myself all over again with how the real world worked. You know, in prison, things are so structured, you know, and things are divided, you know, racially divided. You know, you're dealing with so many, so much negative behind bars to, like, when you finally come home and, you know, people are being all kind to you and nice to you, you got to second guess them. You know, are you being nice or are you being sneaky? You know, you know, your mind is pissed on you because you came from such a crazy world, man, and you come back to the real world and, you know, it's just the contrast is just completely different. But you just got to take it all in, man, and you just got to know that the hard part, the prison part of it, you know, is behind me now. You know, it, what's in front of me is what I make it. You know, I can make it hard and hang on to things that I know I don't need to hang on to emotionally and mentally. Or I could you know, say, okay, today is today, and this is where I am, and so I'm going to make the best of today, and we'll worry about tomorrow when tomorrow comes. No, it's not guaranteed.
Now, I know you tried out for numerous NFL teams in 2012, the Chiefs, the Chargers, 49ers, Seahawks. Mm-hmm. Pete Carroll, who recruited you to USC back in 2002, invited you to Seahawks minicamp, but you were not signed. Yeah. But what is Brian Banks doing today? Are you married? Mm-hmm. How do you make a living? What is your world like?
Yeah. Man, I'm a very quiet person, man. I don't party. I don't hang out with the who's. I don't really care about tangible things as far as jewelry and cars and clothes. I'm very laid back and don't really care for it. You know, it's funny. I got a movie and a book and all stuff coming out. I don't really care about attention and none of that stuff. I got a 6-month-old boy at home now. I got a little baby. I'm a father now. My first little one. I've got a beautiful girlfriend who's been holding it down and being my rock, and she's great. The three of us have a little family. You know, I got a service dog here at home. He's a pit bull mixed with Rhodesian Ridgeback, a 5-year-old boy.
Wow.
I just wrote my book, What Set Me Free. It's in stores now all over the place. This movie, obviously, I'm working on. I'm still traveling around the country speaking. You know, I'm a nationally recognized speaker, so that's always going to be something that I'm going to continue to do. I sit on the advisory board of the California Innocence Project. I also sit on the advisory board of the National Registry of Exonerations. So I think that I'll always be in the lane of advocating for those who cannot speak for themselves, the voiceless, which are people behind bars for crimes that they did not commit, people who have experienced this flawed judicial system and got the raw end of the deal. I'll always be fighting for them. You know, this movie, Brian Banks, is titled Brian Banks, but it's really symbolic of the many, many people before me and unfortunately those after me that will and have experienced wrongful conviction. So I mean I'm definitely in the space where I was raised and where I came from, and I'm still going to be there, continuing to fight for those who can't fight for themselves, and just trying to leave a great legacy for my little one, man, and uphold the promise that I gave my mom at a really young age of being a good man. I told her when I was young, I'm gonna be a good man. She said, all right. Well, she did a good job raising me, man, because. I've been keeping up to my end of the deal.
You mentioned the book, What Set Me Free. We got the movie, Brian Banks, and you mentioned that you do speaking. And it's interesting because as I asked you for what you do today, and I know you mentioned that you advocate for the wrongfully convicted people and you serve on that board and you do all kinds of good. But I was thinking you would be a great speaker. And you said, that's what I do. I speak. And I'm curious, when you do speak, what is the message, your basic message that you impart to those groups that you do speak with?
Yeah, the basic message is the power of choice. That's always one of my top subjects. I did two forms of speaking engagements. I'll go to law schools or different programs that are of the legal side of things or the law side of things, and I'll educate people about wrongful convictions by using my story and pulling from examples. The other is the more motivational and inspirational component, which is The Power of Choice. One of the best books that I've ever read, besides my book, is this book called As a Man Thinketh by James Allen. And the premise of that book is what the mind creates and what the heart manifests, so shall it be. You know, we often create where we want to be and what we want to have in our life, but not often do we make it true to us. So we say things like, I shoulda, I coulda, I woulda, or one day I'm gonna. You know, but once you make that creation true to you, then you begin to see your life revolve around that truth, from the people you hang around with, the things that you do, your priorities, what's important to you, what you watch on TV. You know, all of that will change once you make something true to you. And so I always talk about the power of choice, that you know, it's the most powerful master. We cannot be moved. And that all falls into our actions, our emotions, our thoughts. You know, those all there's choices that are made before all of those things take place. And imagine if you could master the art of controlling and having the power over the choices that you make in life. That means you can control the way you feel. You can control the things that you do. You can control how you respond to situations, because you've been working on mastering the art of controlling that power and in making the right choices in life. And so I'm always talking about that, you know, because people always are constantly asking, how did you get through it? How did you deal with it? How are you still happy today? Well, it sounds easier said than done, but really it was a choice. It is a choice every single day that I get out of bed to be happy, to not allow one moment in time to dictate the duration of my life, for me to choose to love people versus to hate people because of one person's actions. You know, those are all choices. You know, experiences don't come with emotion. We give emotion to experiences. So if we can control and have power over our emotions, then no one else could have power over.
Great message. Now, what would be the message, Brian, that you hope people take away from the upcoming movie based on your life?
Yeah, that we cannot continue to sweep issues such as wrongful conviction, flawed judicial system. We can't keep sweeping these things under the rug. At some point, we have to really come to terms that our system is not perfect and that scale of justice is off balance. You know, there are too many stories such as Brian Banks or the documentary When They See Us, the Central Park Five, or Fruitvale Station. You know, there's so many stories that we should know about, because there's so many people who are not informed about these types of tragedies that happen in our society. And, you know, we want to have a system, we want to have a judicial system where it in fact protects the innocent. But if we put innocent people behind bars for crimes that they didn't commit, all we're doing is adding to the list of victims. And so I think that it's important that I use my story and my hardships as a learning lesson, as a tool for people to become informed about our system, in hopes that it invokes change, it invokes conversation that can lead to change, and that people play their part in some way to protect all innocent people. And that includes the people that are currently, as we speak and do this interview, behind bars, in a cage like an animal right now for something that they didn't do. Some on death row, potentially being put to death, knowing that they didn't commit this crime. So I think it's important that people get that from this story. And also, I hope that people get from the story, it's not what you go through, but how you allow it to affect you, what you choose to do as a response moving forward, because what you do in that moment determines what happens next. And so I hope people walk out of the theaters being empowered, being self-empowered, knowing that they have more strength and more power within them than they think that they do, and that I didn't do anything special other than just never giving up. I didn't allow this situation to break me, and I hope that I can give that same inspiration to others, if need be, make a sword out of me.
Let me say this. I am truly sorry to hear everything that you had to go through, but your loss, going to college, going to USC, playing in the NFL, was a gain for so many other people, for the California Innocence Project, for all the people who would be inspired for your story, for all the people who you help who are being wrongfully convicted. And the messages that you give in your book and in this movie and on your speaking tour and here on this podcast today are something that people do need to pay attention to. And it's hard not to listen to you and be inspired and moved and touched and honored that we get to hear your message. It's incredible.
Yeah. Thank you, brother. I really appreciate it. You know, it's, and I'll I'll share the same sentiment, man. It's an honor to be on the phone with you, to be a part of this podcast, because I know, you know, how magnified your voice is and how people respond to you. So the fact that you and I could come together to talk about a serious subject such as this and get this message across different platforms to people who may not be aware of it. I mean, this is an amazing opportunity, and this is the space that I've been telling people that I'm so happy and thankful to be in, that I can turn my hardships into a lesson for others, man. This is really the only reason why I'm doing it. My family and I had to make a decision, you know, when I was being approached about making this our story into a movie. You know, this is, we had to talk about it. Is this something that we want to do? Do we want to open our lives up and be that vulnerable? For people to actually see what we went through as a family. And ultimately we came to the conclusion that it was important that we did do this, not just for us. Like, yeah, we want people to know what we went through, but moreover, man, we want people to understand that this is not an isolated issue. This is happening across the board to all walks of life, man, to, you know, black, white, brown, old, young, boy, girl, kid, adult. America, different countries, we should all, and I think we all agree that no one deserves to be put in a cage for something that they didn't do, regardless of you know, your race, your color, your political background, whatever it is, religion. Nobody deserves that. No one deserves to be treated that way.
And so, but let me say this to you, Brian. The honor was mine, because when this podcast started some 2.5 years ago, the idea was to bring different voices and personalities to people, mostly with football. And again, we had the excuse built in that you were supposed to go to USC. You tried out for the NFL. You worked at the 2014 Rookie Symposium, hired by Roger Goodell in the league office to speak to that group of rookies. You've done work in and around the NFL, but that is just a vehicle that allows you to be on this podcast. And I've never been prouder to have a guest on here in the 2.5 years that I've done it than to have you speak up about these issues and share your experience with all the listeners today.
Thank you, brother. I really appreciate the opportunity, man. I really do. Thank you.
Brian, my pleasure, my honor, and good luck with the movie, and good luck with all the greatness and all the great things that lay ahead for you.
Thanks, Adam.
I mean, I don't even know what to say other than wow. What an inspirational figure. What an incredible man. What a tremendous message. We wish Brian Banks nothing but the best going forward, and know that he will have great success in all that awaits him. His movie opens Friday. The Brian Banks movie should be fantastic to watch. A special thank you to Brian Banks for joining this podcast. And a special thanks to my friend, my new teammate, Pat McAfee, who will be a part of ESPN's Thursday Night College Football package, as well as the Get Upset. And I know he's going to do a great job. Two great men. Two entirely different stories, two inspirational figures. Hope everybody enjoyed this week's podcast. Please join us again next week for another Adam Schefter podcast. Have a great week, everybody.